Hello, everyone, and welcome to Book Spider, a Book of the Week format podcast, roughly speaking, I guess better described as a podcast which is often but not always Book of the Week format, which strives to digest the whole past, present, and future of the literary form and weave it into new ways of understanding the ways in which texts help us understand. Today we're looking at two pieces that were... Oh, shut up. That's a good intro. Fuck you.
I didn't say anything. I just chuckled a little bit.
I'm keeping that snicker in. I am. I was trying, guys. You know me. I'm not good at the intros. I apologize. With me today are the two regular co-hosts of Book Spider, Patrick Barney, who you just heard, and Chris Mountberg. So today we're looking at two pieces that were originally distributed as Substack newsletters. Naomi Kanakia's Lonely Island Adventures and Sam Criss's The Law That Can Be Named Is Not the True Law. And I found these interesting, I think, as... we'll talk a little bit about form later in the podcast, but these were both pieces that I received by email as subscribers of these newsletters that struck me as interesting attempts to use the format of the email newsletter to kind of discreetly attempt, maybe not new, but at least somewhat inspired blendings of essay and fiction techniques. So I was formally impressed enough by these, intrigued enough by these, that I wanted to discuss it with the guys. Just to give a brief overview of both articles, for lack of a better word, Lonely Island Adventures was published via Kanakia's Woman of Letters newsletter on September 25th, 2025, discusses the history of a 20th century pulp magazine called Lonely Island Adventures, and that pulp magazine only published stories of people from various times and places being marooned on islands, often in ways which revealed complex psychosocial elements. The newsletter discusses the most respected of these authors, Mary Sterling, a writer who is particularly concerned with the ways in which the Lonely Island format emphasizes themes of loneliness. Sterling publishes a novel called The Stalwart, originally in Lonely Island Adventures. The Stalwart is a dissection of the trope of the left-handed and right-handed woman in which a male protagonist must choose between a civilized, graceful woman and a raw, primitive, dark-skinned one. But this particular story ends with the surprising revelation that before the shipwreck, the man was married to the left-handed woman, a.k.a. the raw, primitive, dark-skinned one, which is a clever way of upsetting the conventions of the Lonely Island story format. Sterling's work was controversial among the Lonely Island community, but she did graduate to more significant literary acclaim. Notably, the pulp, the whole idea of the Lonely Island format as a short story format, and Mary Sterling are all fictional inventions as revealed at the end of the newsletter, although most readers would begin to suspect it by that point. I suppose the two of you didn't have the full context for this, but many of Kanakia's newsletters are, like, if you imagine this newsletter but not made up, generally speaking, much of what she does is kind of this... excavation of cultural history, of kind of peripheral literary forms that have gone by the wayside. So, for instance, you know, not too long before this, she had done a couple of newsletters about O. Henry, who was a very acclaimed short story writer in his time, who is, you know, mostly kind of regarded as a joke now. So the format is very conventional to her normal style, except that in this one instance, it's all made up. Sam Criss's The Law That Can Be Named Is Not the True Law was published through his Numb at the Lodge newsletter on July 13 of 2025. It begins as a critique of the British government's decision to designate Palestine Action as a terror group. Criss notes that under the terms of the law, arguing against that designation could be construed as a violation of the law. So it is a law whose actions cannot be protested without violating the law. Chris then goes on to discuss the history of public and private legal codes, notably the American Patriot Act, which contains classified sections, which is to say the Patriot Act is a law under which citizens can be prosecuted even though they aren't allowed to view the law under which they will be prosecuted. He then connects that to the Secret Society of the Poro, a kind of transnational legal organization that certain African tribes participated in. While all of the examples he's covered up until this point have been true to whatever approximation of the idea of truth is appropriate for the type of writing he's doing, he then transitions into the tale of the fictional Laurentius Klung, who was a heretic tried under British law for speaking a heresy so forbidden that it could not be disclosed to any witness, thus producing logistical difficulties in his trial. And he was tried by a barrister who may or may not have been an ancestor of modern British Prime Minister Keir Starmer. So, you know, this might be a tiresome question, but I kind of wanted to start just by thinking about, from the standpoint of genre and form, how we would characterize these pieces, right? Are they doing something which feels new in their hybridization, or are there clear antecedents in the world of experimental fiction or creative nonfiction?
The first thing I thought of when you asked that question was something like Talon Ukbar Orbis Tertius by... what's his name? Jorge Luis. Yeah, Borges. I don't necessarily think it's like a straight up one-to-one comparison, but like I remember in the forms of nonfiction class that you and I shared, Hans. I don't know if you were in it, Chris. That story, that fiction, was presented as a form of nonfiction that we read, which I think we mostly agreed was BS in class discussion. Right. But at least for the first. The first essay, the Lonely Island Adventures, well, it seems like a fairly similar concept, like essayist presents fictional information as if it were real information. Now that doesn't quite work. Not really. I don't know.
Well, it's fictional information presented in a format that suggests nonfictional information and presented right. in a manner that does not contain the usual stylistic signposts of fiction.
Right.
Yeah, I would say the thing that comes to mind is how these two pieces are very different. Because you said, you know, signposting. Is it Kanakia? I know we'll
go with that.
Kanakia. Kanakia's piece is actually pretty transparent about its fictional nature. And that's easier because it's fictional, like from the top rung all the way down. She doesn't come forward and say that until you've read the whole thing. But in a way that packages the whole piece very differently from Chris's piece. Where there's this kind of shifty gradient between truth and fiction. And I think that makes them very different from one another. I don't know, like, yeah, Borges didn't come to mind until you named him, but that's a pretty obvious, I think, connection between with Kanakia. I'm trying to think of, it almost feels more like how poetry can sort of start from empirical reality and jump into a new universe. Chris's piece. I feel like Neal Stephenson or other sort of historical fiction writers who use established events and real figures in history to you know, Sotweed Factor comes to mind too. There's a little bit of that in Chris's piece, but I actually kind of think of them as very different from one another. And Chris's piece is potentially more problematic because it doesn't really signpost where it becomes fiction.
I like the comparison to historical fiction with Chris, actually. It's like an inversion of historical fiction, right? You think about something like a lot of what Neal Stephenson does, and you have a process where you start with real characters and events from remote history, and then you kind of add fiction on top, which mainly occurs in the present, right? Something like the Baroque cycle, you know, you have a set of true historical groundings, which kind of lead to and underpin a set of different events in the present in Cryptonomicon. And you kind of have a reverse here of that, where you take a true present and trace it back to a historical past, which isn't necessarily any different, I think, in terms of the amount of truth and fiction that are contained in one piece. It's just that they're blended in kind of a mirror way of how we're used to. I mean, on some level, like, in a way, all fiction is historical fiction, right? Because all fiction, other than a very small number of things, like, all fiction takes place in a world which contains some overlap with ours, right? But in this, in many cases, there's kind of like an assumed past that is pretty much like ours, underpinning current events that are different. And here you have current events that are essentially reported journalistically, or at least, you know, reported in a way that is much more like a newspaper editorial. But then, you know, the history that precedes it then is fictional, which is a very, it's like the amount is no different, really, right? It's just distributed differently than we're used to.
It makes me think about the kind of like the on-ramp into the awe-inspiring or the mystery. You know, you say like almost all fiction is historical in some regard, and you know, stories that are sort of digging into conspiracy or the lesser known, the mysterious sort of threads. I'm thinking about also, I guess, like Pynchon and Garden of Seven Twilights a little bit, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The anchor in a real place, I think that there is probably, I'd say that you're generally right, but I do think that there is some established sort of trope of anchoring in the present and then fabulating the past. I think that ramp can go either way, and it is a lot about like sort of connecting this strange place that we end up in to a more mundane, real feeling place. And I think that Chris's piece does a pretty, like, very convincing job of starting now and then creating a kind of a past that is alarming and different and feels like if you just started there that it wouldn't feel real, because because of the order that I read these in. You know, I feel like I would have been convinced of Chris's piece without you know, knowing or expecting it to, you know, fabulate But I read Canonicus first, and I figured there was something connecting these two.
This is such an obvious question that it's both maybe less interesting, but also something that has to be kind of approached, and we might as well approach it. This piece by Chris received some criticism for blending fact and fiction in ways that are not clearly signposted within the piece, and some observers found that choice to be irresponsible. For what it's worth, pretty much all of his writing does some amount of this. Laurentius Klung is a recurring character in, well, I think has only recurred twice, but, you know, this appearance made him a recurring character, so somebody who read the newsletters regularly would have already, presumably, if they cared, have known that Laurentius Klung was a fictional character. But, I mean, because it's the internet, right, context collapse does apply. And a number of people read this who were just, you know, socially conscious people who were interested in the you know, terror laws in Britain and who did not have the context to go, okay, well, I need to approach this with the knowledge that at some point there will be a transition into fable, right? And not everything Chris writes does that either, so... but all just kind of coming around to the question of, you know, Chris, you'd used the word problematic in discussing that blending. I don't know if you meant that in the internet sense or the more general sense, but do you agree that there's an irresponsibility in the way that fact and invention are mingled here, and why or why not?
I don't know. I think that it is, colored by AI and by the so-called enshittification of the internet and slop, and the ways in which reality is refracted endlessly now, like from what could be considered a true locus at the center to, you know, whatever audience, you know, however an audience wants to see the world or fears seeing the world. And I don't know if it's better for us to play with that and grow stronger in navigating that, or to police it and to be more strict about holding that center and signposting when we're deviating from it. But that drift into fable, that drift into a made-up story, is very reminiscent of how an AI, especially like at the edge of its context window, when it starts to lose track of the threads that it's supposed to keep hold of, but it has, you know, whatever, it was asked to write 5,000 words and it's written 3,000. It needs 2,000 more words, but it's no longer capable of holding that center, and it just, without missing a beat or having any conscience about it whatsoever, because it doesn't have a conscience, it's a machine, it just continues and does not signpost at all. So that almost felt on purpose to me. I don't know his writing or his if he ever addresses AI or if it was just a coincidence, but it felt very reminiscent of an AI hallucination that is, I think, especially, that's why I use the word problematic. I think that it would not be, I don't think, the problematic in at all the same way 20 years ago. But now it is, I think, it's extraordinarily salient to the place that we are in right now, where truth just blends directly into conspiracy or fiction, and we don't, as a society, know how to navigate that. So I don't know if I punted on that or not. I don't know. Maybe we need more stories like this to practice navigating that, or we should be brutal and strict and say this is actually irresponsible to do this sort of thing.
Patrick, I'll admit, When I was sending this to everybody, I thought about this piece. I feel like Patrick is either really going to like this or kind of casually dismiss it. And I couldn't figure out. I wasn't sure which of those two it would be.
You know, I think there's definitely the question of whether it's problematic. That wasn't the first thing my mind went to, though. The first thing my mind went to was that the slide into fiction makes these less good, is what I think.
Both of these? Or yeah. More so the Chris?
Both of them.
Because the Kanaki is entirely fiction. But
Yeah, I said slide into fiction, but what I meant by slide into fiction, at least in the Lonely Island Adventures, you know, it's revealed at the end that, oh, this is all made up, this is entirely fiction. And to me, I guess that seems like laziness as a like it's a lazy thing. Like either she wanted to write like a cool, interesting, experimental story like about this made up genre, in which case it would have been like a cool, interesting story about a made up genre, and that could have been a cool, like maybe metafictional technique or some kind of experimental fiction exercise. But presenting it as nonfiction and then like saying, I was just playing. That strikes me as like, there are a lot of great nonfiction stories that can be told, right? There are plenty of fantastic little bits of history that have yet to be kind of written about or played with or discussed in an essay. And so to me, I was a little disappointed that like I'm expecting like some kind of like I'm reading this as if it's an interesting historical tidbit that I'm learning about, and it turns out it's more like a flight of fancy. And I don't think there's any real reason to do that. That's my take on the Lonely Island Adventure story. And I think that there's a similar issue with the law that the true law cannot be named. Is that the title?
The law that can be spoken is not the true law.
The law that can be spoken is not the true law. It's a similar issue, but also a little different. The point here is that like, instead of making some type of essayistic point about secret laws or like kind of the weird logical contradiction of requiring people to conform to a rule that they are not allowed to know about, instead of like really kind of exposing it in, say, like an Orwellian way, which is something Orwell probably would have done. Instead of doing anything like that, we have like a fictional addendum, and I'm not sure what the point of, like, I'm willing to let you guys convince me that there is a good point and there is something reasonable there, but I'm not quite sure what that is right now, if that makes sense. And I agree in the sense that not necessarily that they're problematic, but that the internet, social media, and now AI has made a truthful, critical understanding of the objective world harder to grasp and harder to come by. And that is definitely a problem. I like Chris, you seem to think these stories are related to that, and I'm willing to hear more about that. That wasn't my first thought though.
I do think that there's probably a question of stakes between these two, right? There's a question of stakes, and each author is handling the stake in like the opposite way of how you would expect, right? Like, there are really no ethical stakes to making up stories about a fake pulp magazine in a non-existent genre 100 years ago.
Right.
So the kind of the mask slip, and there are a couple of mask slips in Lonely Island Adventures. One of those is the obvious one at the end where there's a little bracket at the end that says, hey, this is all made up, FYI, which I found somewhat maddening, right? Because it feels like a disclaimer against the sort of people who are, it's like a disclaimer against kind of Philistines, right? Like the kind of people that would go around being upset that you weren't clear about your, you know, like if in the process of reading the thing, you don't think at the end, like, this is invention, then you're not somebody whose judgment should be pandered to because you're just lacking in discernment enough that you're kind of, I don't know. I just don't like seeing that prioritized in that manner again, because like,
and I'd be one of those people. I had no idea that this was fiction until she said this is fiction. So.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Interesting. But would you have felt, you know, if we said in discussing it that it was fiction, would you have felt ethically offended, or would you just kind of have gone, oh, haha, clever gambit, Naomi?
Like, if I had known, if you had told me this is a short story before I had read it.
Well, no, if you had read it, and then you read my questions and realized it was invented.
If I had read it and thinking it was an essay and she didn't reveal it?
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. If she hadn't revealed it and I had not ever caught on, I would be like, well, that's a dirty trick. Yeah, I'd be like, that's underhanded. No, thank you.
I think that, like, I mean, there's that. There's the explicit reveal at the end, but there's something also about the way, when I was reading it, there was something about the way that Mary Sterling gradually emerges as a character, right? The way that it kind of narrows in on, the way that it really describes her subjectivity and process and ideas and thoughts in, and that begins to feel, even though, like, there, it's not impossible to have, you know, journalistic writing or essayistic writing that uses that technique, that still felt to me like she was being treated more like a fictional character in how her subjectivity was presented and how her life was presented. Particularly, you know, for something like this that's not a fully researched book, right? It's just an email newsletter. Like how, you know. And I think that I when I was reading it, I felt like that kind of, that slip, by the time I got to the note, I was already pretty sure it was fiction, right? And so I thought that slip, that kind of genre drift was interesting from a craft perspective, but also made the note somewhat irrelevant. But it sounds like that was not a universal experience.
I just think that it's a wasted opportunity to do something more. Because
I was just going to ask if you meant more like.
No, like, I was just going to say that and then jump to a totally different topic.
Oh, all right. Like, go ahead. No worries.
No, I'm fucking with you. No. yes, I'm going to explain it. By more, you're going to ask, like, what do I mean by more?
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask.
I kind of wondered if it was not real, not for the Mary Sterling characterization, but because the quotes pulled from the Lonely Island writers were a little bit too pithy and perfect. Not pithy. That's the wrong way of putting it. They were too, it was too well constructed. Like it was just it, like everything was tying up really neat and quickly and economically. The quotes that she was pulling were saying what she needed them to say to propel the story forward or to do, you know, this or that thing without taking up too much space or needing any kind of like additional notes, stuff like that. It was just, it was too easy. Like, I think if you're taking the mess of history and trying to kind of like, and you're doing research and pulling things together, you have to do a lot more explaining, and you have to navigate a bunch more like shaggy mess. And this was much more, this felt like a short story. So I had that sense, but when I got to the end, I was a little bit, I wasn't disappointed. I was actually, I felt kind of affirmed, you know, like, oh, I thought it maybe it wasn't real. So I don't know that I felt the way that you did, Hans, but thinking back on it, it really feels like the process of reading it and thinking about it as, you know, a story, you know, when you start thinking about it as an essay and then you come to think about it as a story, it would be interesting to have her comment on that at the end, rather than just basically, you know, CYA, you know? And so like, I do think that it is probably, I'll disagree with you, Hans. I think it's probably a good idea for someone who's used, her readership is used to reading these and thinking that they're real, to kind of let this hang out there. I think it's probably, it's just too risky for, I think, like, if she's
what is the risk? What's the worst case scenario?
I don't know. Her readership gets offended and she's, you know, she's on Substack. So she's not, she is her own brand a little bit. So like, I think that, you know, it's not like she's writing for, you know, the New Yorker or, you know, the Boston Herald or something like that, where it's like people are going to continue to, like, if they're offended by one article, they're going to continue to buy newspapers, and she's kind of protected by the broader portfolio of the organization that she belongs to. But, you know, she's kind of her own brand, so she kind of has to think a little bit defensively and about that, I think. So I think that it would probably be a little bit strange for her to not come forward and say something. And when she does come forward and say something, I think it does basically release her from any, you know, like, she's not doing anything wrong. You know, maybe it's a little bit of a dirty trick. Maybe it's a little bit lazy. Maybe she doesn't get anything more out of it, but that's only because it's kind of just not doing very much that afterward. You know, if she was going to use the afterward to do a little bit of like a reflection on the whole, like that tension between truth and fiction, I think that would be a little bit more interesting, but that's just not why she wrote the piece, I guess. So, I don't feel like Patrick, I don't know that I have the strong reaction that you have, but I think I'm more in line with you. I think that it's better to be forthright, which is why, again, Chris's piece is maybe the more problematic one and definitely the more interesting one. She almost makes her piece less interesting because of her choice. And Chris, you know, Chris's piece is something to chew on.
You're right that Chris's piece is something to chew on. And I've been pondering, I will say I like Chris's piece, right? I like it a lot. I like his writing a lot. I'm very fond of his style. I have not necessarily thought at length about why it is that I like it. My instinct is to defend the kind of the particular blend that he does. I do think that it probably, he's in very tricky territory here, right? Because he's doing something that is normally perceived to have a social function, and he's prioritizing aesthetic functions. And I think that's probably a lot of what upset people about this article in particular, right? that for a brief period of time, it seems to be very powerful as, maybe not very powerful, but for a brief period of time, it seems to be reasonably effective as a tool of social polemic. You know, if you were to just have the parts about the designation of Palestine Action as a terror group and about the Patriot Act, you know, like if you take that 20% of the piece and isolate it, I think it would be a reasonably effective critique of those things. And I understand why somebody might want, you know, those pieces as they exist in the overall work, and then you add in, you know, about the same amount of this is bad, laws should be freely available to the public, we should be able to criticize, like, just, you know, the kind of straightforward editorializing that kind of explains the point in a you know, unmuddy way. I don't think I would enjoy reading that, you know, and the ways it, the article has, I think, or the piece has both an aesthetic and a moral purpose, right? The aesthetic purpose being that he just seems to find it really interesting to delve into all these historical examples in ways that I think in some cases probably are blending to the little bit that I was able to tell, blending historically verifiable research and invention in somewhat unclear ways. I think, I don't know, there's a particular kind of aesthetic joy in this kind of broad tableau of invented things and real things and kind of the cleverness with which both of those are discussed. That is somewhat at odds, I suppose, with the social purpose of protesting these laws. I do feel like, you know, contextually, there's such an enormous amount of writing in the world and speaking in the world that is purely social in its function, right? That would make a similar or identical point that if nothing else, I feel like the social value of it is maybe less of a concern in a world that's like already glutted with, you know, purely socially oriented text, right? And to the question of whether or not what he's doing here ultimately serves to, if you do want to think about it from a social standpoint, is what he's doing here, is he ultimately actually protesting the designation of Palestine Action as a terror group in a way that's more effective or differently effective than if it were a shorter, simpler, straight polemic? That's hard to say, right? I mean, if nothing else, like this piece received a great deal of attention from people who were reading it, trying to figure out how much of it was true. It did draw attention to the absurdity of the way that the law functions around that designation, right? So and you know, you make the point of AI, Chris. Like, I know from experience, if you Google Laurentius Klung or some of the other invented folks, the AI will tell you these are inventions from Sam Chris's essay, "The Law That Can Be Named Is Not the True Law," right? Paradoxically, he's created a situation where the AI is the, maybe not paradoxically, but he's created a situation where the AI is the, somewhat reliable voice of authority, and the human invented thing has the hallucination in it, right? But yeah, I mean, I think that I think that the aesthetic value of it, either you feel it or you don't on some level, right? If it wasn't intriguing and interesting and amusing to read this, I don't have a great argument for why it should be. Right, I found it, those things, but I don't have a great argument for why you should share that. The social purpose of it, I think, is, you know, the arguments you can make are either that the daringness of the form draws attention to the uninvented part, or that that it's satire, right? That the, you know, you establish a set of principles characteristic of British law at the beginning. And then you take those same principles and imagine kind of this absurd logical extension of them. And it satirizes the absurdity of those principles. You take a set of bizarre characters acting out a law that in effect functions under the same principles as the real current laws, and it further it makes us more acutely, intensely aware of the absurdity of the law as it exists currently. A little bit like, I don't know, like Starship Troopers or something, right? Like Starship Troopers, you have this kind of, you take the principles of fascism and you enact them in this especially absurd way. And the end result is to create a heightened understanding of the absurdity of the principles of fascism, right? Like this is the Laurentius Klung sections are like Starship Troopers for opaque British law.
I think that because the law and the concept of truth are really intertwined, that there is a resonance there that you know, like, and that's going back to my sort of conjecture about maybe in the time of AI, we need more of this sort of thing to push us to disentangle, to grow that muscle of disentangling, rather than simply believing what we read. You know, I feel like it is either sort of like a regulatory thing or it is a reader muscle thing. And probably it's a little bit of both. But I think that, like, that works. But I want to go back to Patrick, because I think Patrick, you suggested that the fiction of this piece, the law that can be spoken is not the true law, is a mistake. And, like, you
sure
you think you would argue for the essayistic piece without the fictional piece.
Yeah, probably.
Why?
Hans is like, well, you know, maybe this works better as a social critique because of this end, which satirizes the whole subject. I mean, sure, that's a good argument, except that there are going to be readers who, like me, who don't get it, you know, like I did not, even though I had already read Lonely Island Adventures and I suspected something, like I did not know when this slipped into fiction, like, you know, the Laurentius Klung stuff. It seemed reasonable to me that you could uncover some weird circumstance like this in I guess it's Elizabethan times. I mean, you know, there are cases of, like, you know, people, courts in backwards areas in Europe trying pigs, you know, like this is, you know, this is, it doesn't seem clear enough as satire to me to be effective at the purpose you were saying that it might have. Just because, like you said in your introduction, there are no signposts. You know, and the thing about satire is it's, you know, satire is great, but it, you know, it's almost always bound to be mistaken in its time. Like, it almost always is. Like, you know, Jonathan Swift got death threats for A Modest Proposal. People are like, how dare you want to kill our children, you know? So I don't know. I don't know.
Does that invalidate the concept of satire? I mean, we mentioned Starship Troopers. Starship Troopers is often mistaken as a straightforwardly fascist movie, or it was when it came out, right? I think it's very broadly understood now. Like, it's your suggestion is that satire is often broadly misunderstood in its time, but it is almost always redeemed by, like, well done satire is always redeemed by history. And I understand the idea that, like, okay, well, these topics are too important to risk misinterpretation, right? That's a reasonable standpoint. And I don't know that I have, I mean, if you don't aesthetically enjoy the thing, then you can't really argue the aesthetic value of it against the...
No, I mean, I actually found I found it super interesting. Like, I enjoyed both pieces a lot, actually. Like, on the, just as like... you know, 25 pages of pleasurable prose, I liked them both. I think that they were both interesting. I liked Chris's, like, he referred to himself as annoyingly ironic, which I thought was hilarious. Yeah, so I don't want to make it like I didn't find these pieces pleasurable. I did. I don't really want to hinge, like, set up a position here where I'm forced to defend a stance against satire, because that would be horrible and stupid, and, like, my own novel is a satire in a lot of ways. So, like, hopefully readers understand, whoever has read it has understood that it's deeply satirical. So, I don't really want to be like saying satire is bad. I think satire is good.
But I'm just like, you want to say that just because something is satire doesn't, or trying to be satire doesn't let it off the hook. Right? Like I think, because I really am not clear myself on whether Chris's piece gets away with it. You know, like, I think that, like, you can try, you know, like, but
sure,
like,
if you should try.
People should try, like, but, you know, then we're the assholes who get to leverage our opinion on, you know, whether you right. succeeded or not. And, like, I think it's fair to say that he didn't. Like, I'm unclear.
Yeah, maybe that's all I would agree to is. Is I'm not, like, I can see a more straightforward social critique minus the satire succeeding, having better success at this subject than this has with me, basically. Is maybe that's all I would really say.
That's fair. So, Patrick, what are we going to read in 2 weeks?
Oh, is it already that time?
It's that time. Already... Hans has got to get the fuck out of that hotel, or they're going to, like, lock him in there start molesting him.
Or they're going to charge me another $100.
Yeah, because of the prostitutes.
Yeah, he'll be stuck as the butt pillow for some other tenant.
I didn't realize that so much time had passed. I was concentrating on what you guys had said and really trying to, like,
that's understand. That's the way to do it.
So yeah, it was a good discussion. Mm-hmm. Have either of you read or seen the movie of Atonement by Ian McEwan?
Both. Yeah.
Man.
Hey, you know what? It's perfect.
You're not picking Atonement, are you?
I don't think I am now, because if you've both read, you can't.
No, I'm not going to be that
being
guy.
A dick.
We read it for comps.
Hans is literally.
We read it for comps. We read it for the fiction MFA comps, and I really hated it.
Hans's essays, like, are sort of like little short atonements. Honestly, like, that's like Hans is like, oh, here,
we'll
read these
fucking Atonement.
Read these little essays that are not essays, because at the end it turns out that the author made it all up. And guess what? A fucking Atonement is about. And then Hans is a bitch about it. Like, he's like, oh no, I don't want to read Atonement.
I don't know. I'll feel differently about it now. We'll read Atonement.
I just read Atonement. I just finished it a couple days ago, and I was like, man. I really like this. It's so connected to, like, our last two episodes, but you're like, I hate this. I don't. Would you rather I pick a different book by McEwan?
No. It's a very good segue. I read it 13 years ago. Maybe I'll feel differently now.
All right.
I loved Waterland 13 years ago, and we hated that when we reread it. So, yeah. Might yeah, be a mirror of that, you know. Maybe my tastes have evolved.
All right, I'm sorry. I was really hoping.
No, don't apologize.
I was really hoping neither of you had read it because I really wanted to get like your gut reaction to the twist.
Sure.
But all right. I'm sorry, Hans. I'm sorry. This is going to be bad. But
we don't know that it's going to be bad, Patrick. You don't have to apologize.
All right.
Such a pleasurable experience to forgive. It'll be my atonement for being mean to it 13 years ago.
All right. I guess we're going to read Atonement. At the very least, Hans, you can tell me why you hated it if you end up hating it, you know?
All right. Well, this has been our discussion of the newsletters of Sam Chris and Naomi Kanakia. Thank you much, everybody, for listening. We'll be back in 2 weeks with Ian McEwan's Atonement, and I'll talk to you then.
Thank you both, guys. Have a great day.